baby, baby, if I touch you like this.
Is this going to be your cold open?
Yep. So that, I mean, it's literally my fantastic karaoke performance.
One day, like, I hope to hear it.
You will. The world will.
Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theater Happy Hour, your weekly podcast with Lutz and Blapfrag. Jimmy typed it.
That was actually, that was very close. Yeah? That was very close.
Is the PH in F? Lafroig. Lafroig?
Yeah. Lafroig.
Is that anything like LaCroix?
No. Is that not LaCroix? Do you not call that LaCroix?
I mean, that might be how it's supposed to be pronounced, but people in the Midwest and people in Colorado definitely say LaCroix. At least they don't say LaCroix.
LaCroix. Okay. So wait. Which demographic is the one that drinks Lafroy? No, not Lafroy. LaCroix. I can't say anything.
Turnabout is fair play. I'd say it's becoming more popular just in general. It's a good, like, that's soda great pop replacement, which, you know, America gravely needs. But it's
very true.
Fizzy water. So it convinces people that it, you know, hits that same whatever.
Delicious. Well,
but wait, what's
Lafroig is whiskey. Yeah.
Oh, whiskey? Oh, that's boring.
Is it? You've just insulted the whole of Scotland.
They're going to be knocking down my door with pitchforks and haggis soon, right?
That's what we do. Oh my God, how good would that be?
Do you protest with haggis? I assume so.
Have you ever had haggis?
No. And I don't plan on it.
Your time will come. Oh, no, it's so good. Yeah. That's the thing, is like, people are like, oh, no, it sounds so gross. Not at all.
Yeah.
Like, it's so worth it. It tastes amazing.
Unless Blue Apron sends it, I don't think it's going to be happening anytime
soon. That's okay. When you find your way across the Atlantic, I'll be shoving haggis down your gullet.
Hey,
that's
now.
That's just the greeting. So, what's on your lips today?
Today, I've got some aged mead that...
I guess
yes,
mead was the only option.
The only thing? Are there any other kinds of...
I don't think they drank anything else in medieval
the 1100s?
Times. I think it was literally... Yeah, I think it was just mead. I mean, medieval, you know what I mean?
I don't think that's how
maybe
that
I don't even think they had water.
No. All the rivers were filled with mead.
Yep, honey-based alcohols. And I actually hate honey, so this is an awful time for me to be drinking mead, but
it's
needs
true.
Must, you know?
It's the things you do for your art.
Thank you, yes. yeah, I've often been compared to, like, Marina Abramovich.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know any other big performance artists, but there you go.
Why are we drinking this mead, Jimmy?
Well, we are drinking this mead because in 1985, the musical that we're talking about today, which was conceived and created by a big league lyricist and librettist, and we're talking big league here,
mm-hmm.
And it proved to be a British hit, and we'll put hit in inverted commas, tried out in a US high school instead of heading straight for Broadway.
What show is this?
It could only be one thing. It is Blondel.
Come back with us to the Middle Ages and hear the story we've rehearsed. A heartwarming story of a medieval minstrel by the name of Blondel and the monarch he served so faithfully, King Richard the First. Richard the Lionheart, in French, Cœur Lion, was, however, the name by which he was known at the time, because, after all, it was 1189, and nobody had heard of Richard II, let alone Richard III.
Gasp with amazement
as the foundations of Plantagenet society are rocked by the gentle twanging of a lute. To the tale of a talented troubadour who became a crusade's most unusual recruit.
Quiver
with emotion through Blondel's desperate five-nation quest with a woman he loved in hot pursuit.
stalks the king with intent to execute.
Benedictus, Benedict, amen.
Benedictus, Benedictus,
all this and more.
Blondel, Blondel. I think they make that joke throughout the show as well.
They kind of do. It's definitely Blondel.
Okay.
The man himself calls him Blondel.
Okay. I will say right off the bat, yeah. I had never, ever, ever heard anything about this show at all.
Yeah.
Until we're doing it for this podcast.
yeah, that's fair. I mean, until it popped up again in the UK this year, I hadn't heard anything about it either.
Yeah.
So that's good. That doesn't often come along.
It's fascinating. So from our quiz question, this musical has book and lyrics by Tim Rice, who is the big league lyricist and librettist.
This is our first Tim Rice.
Is this our first Tim Rice?
How Rice.
How have we gotten through so many Lloyd Webbers and not hit a single Almost Tim 50. Rice?
I know. Well, we've done all the bad ones. yeah, exactly.
So the story goes, Tim Rice was working on this show, Blondel, with Andrew Lloyd Webber in mind, but then Jesus Christ Superstar kind of took over the plate, and then he later collaborated with a guy named Stephen Oliver, who is apparently an opera music writer.
Yeah, he's an opera guy. He's done a few things, but nothing nothing groundbreaking. And I don't know enough about the opera world to talk about his success.
Yeah, and this is certainly, they call this a rock opera, which I think maybe we'll talk about in a bit, because that might even be a misnomer.
Yeah, definitely.
But this is by no means an opera.
No, it's not. It's not at all. So it opened up in London at the Aldwych Theatre after a really successful run in the Bristol Old Vic, because it was there for about 11 months.
Yeah, played for quite a while.
Across.
Yeah, but apparently the transfer did not do too well, partially because of cost and maybe because of subject matter.
Yeah, no, I think it was mostly cost, and they basically said that it was just too much to run in that big a theatre, which is a shame, because I think it had already kind of developed a fan base.
Yeah.
And then it was like, uh-oh. And then obviously, if you're closing there, you're not going to go back off. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be like, whoops, we tried. Away we go. So that was a shame. And it popped back up again in 2006 with some new music, some new stylings at the, I think it was the Southwark. And then came back again this year.
Yeah.
At the Union Theatre. So these are all off West End theatres. It's never come back on West End.
And this, I think, in each incarnation has been slightly rewritten and tweaked. This is something I think people are still trying to get right a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
This is intriguing to me, and I can only find so much information, and then one very strange YouTube interview with Tim Rice.
That is an odd interview, yeah.
But he has a relationship with the director at the El Paso Dinner Theater in Texas, who apparently...
We all do.
Right?
We all
who
know
doesn't,
Greg. Right? You know Greg.
I know Greg. I'm in El Paso all the time. Is his name Greg?
El Paso,
I don't know.
Texas. His name's Greg, yeah.
All right. But they do Blondel. They have done it apparently several times. And at one point, Tim Rice worked on some rewrites and renamed it Loot. But that doesn't seem to have stuck. And it's kind of back to its Blondel bit now.
Yeah. It seems almost like in the States, it's Loot.
Yeah.
And over here, it's still just Blondel.
So before we get into the summary, because this will affect things, is this, when I watch 1776, there's some Americanisms in there that I've kind of related to, or maybe let's say Hamilton, and not that medieval Europe is quite as comparable, but I had never heard
a couple of years in between,
right? But I'd never heard of the maybe fictional minstrel player Blondel as a character or an archetype before this musical. Is that a thing you knew about, or am I just...
No, not really. So medieval history, I ain't no expert, because it spans a very, very long time, and there is so much there. I mean, like there are scholars upon scholars upon scholars of this stuff.
Okay.
And there is so much in there. Because it all kind of centered in England and then kind of spanned out across the world, there's just so much there. You know, with something like, you know, your 1776 and your American Declaration of Independence, all that, it's very concentrated.
It's very contained.
One place and one event.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the Crusades, which is the topic of, well, one of the kind of topics of this musical, you know, spanned out into Africa and Asia. Yeah. And we don't really have a handle on that.
It's a lot to cover. So let's.
It's a lot to cover, yeah.
I was new to this story. We should tell people what this musical is about, because I bet you a lot of people haven't heard it.
Yeah, it is based on like a possibly like apocryphal kind of lore style tale.
Yeah.
About Richard the Lionheart. Do you know even who Richard the Lionheart? Have you heard of him?
I mean, I've heard him as like an answer on Jeopardy. But beyond you know, I'm not a Richard the Lionheart. Richard the Third, he is technically. Is that right?
Richard the First. He's
Richard
number
the
one.
First. Okay.
Yep. So he, basically, kind of became a legend in his own time, because of his kind of pursuit of the Crusades, and kind of leading that charge, and then all of the stuff with the ransom. That happened in Austria, which is, again, kind of happens in
the story.
Show.
Yeah.
And so there was lots of hype about him. And so I've read a couple of things, you know, medieval literature. We've all read some.
We've all. I've got a whole bookshelf. That's not true.
Absolutely. but I was reading a couple of things about, he was kind of, he's kind of like the most known about king that nobody knows anything about. I'm sure that was something like the quote. Because he's got this like legend status, you never really know much of the actual facts.
Right.
There's so much that's been written about him.
That makes sense. Like, he entered myth so quickly that it was hard to separate that out from what he actually was.
Exactly. So that's him. And Blondel was his like really faithful, loyal minstrel, apparently, who basically, when Richard the Lionheart was out, and I think he'd been captured by the Duke of Austria, Blondel basically found him very conveniently by playing underneath the windows of different prison cells a song that he once played in the court, and found the right one, because Richard the Lionheart was like, this tune, because apparently he wrote lots of music. So Richard the Lionheart apparently wrote lots of music instead of, well, Blondel probably did as well, maybe.
Right.
But it was one of Richard's songs that apocryphally Blondel played. And Richard was like, it's me, I'm here. And
then he let down his hair and Blondel climbed the tower. Now, so this musical centers around Blondel kind of in this story, but it's, the tagline, I think, very amply describes it. This is a musical from the 80s, the 1180s. Yes. And so there's this very apocryphal juxtaposition of this kind of, I would say, a very Tim Rice kind of sound.
My God, yeah.
You know.
Well, actually, no, well, that's the thing is, like, Tim Rice sound. I want to pin that and capture that phrase. And then we're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Exactly.
Because that's a very interesting point. But yeah, and also, we haven't done that much from the 80s.
No, we haven't.
I don't think.
We've done plenty from the 70s. And this is certainly in that weird kind of 70s bit that my boyfriend doesn't like. But it's in the 80s instead.
Yeah, exactly. We're in Chessland now. It's great.
We are in Chessland. And so there's, you know, the whole thing is narrated by a quartet of four monks. There's a lot of comedy and contemporary reference. This is not a musical that takes itself very seriously. It's kind of like Spamalot meets Pippin with some 80s rock thrown in.
Yeah, I guess there's elements. There's kind of elements of everything. It's just very fun. That's the thing.
It's
a constant comedy. It never steeps itself into the realm of like darkness, or, you know, barely goes heavy. You know, it's not like JC.
Exactly.
It's not anything like that. It's just a good. It's a good laugh.
It's a good romp.
So should we get into it?
Sure. Let's go.
I don't built your burning quest to write, to change the world, to prove when you create that you're the best. And even though I love your music and never think your words banal, enough's enough, my poet pal. How long can someone wait? Forever's just a little long. All your impossible dreams put me wrongly in. Show my heart belongs to you.
But I'm one song away from the breakthrough.
No, you're one song away from goodbye.
After all I've been through for your sake.
Through the word we are through, you and I.
I know you think I ought to burn my lute, but realize I'm me, and like the tide, I can't be turned. Canute would sympathize, and even though my songs aren't played much, and I've never won a million hearts, I cannot stop performing arts. How long can someone wait? Forever's just a little long. Why should my chosen career put me wrongly in
first,
the
right, I'm going to pinch that little phrase that you took there. Bloop. Where you said it's got a very Tim Rice sound. Because, no, obviously Tim Rice isn't a musician.
Right.
I don't know, he may play music.
Mm-hmm.
Who I'm not one to say. but what he is a, you know, he's a lyric writer. He's a librettist. Yeah. And, but listening to this, uh-huh. I was like, you could spot this a mile off that this is Rice. Well, because it sounds, to me, I'm like, I feel like I'm listening to Chess. I'm listening to Jesus Christ Superstar. I'm listening to Evita. Like, it, do you know,
And I wonder, I have hypothesis theories about this sort of thing.
Hypotheses, yeah.
Hypotheses. That sort of Tim Rice sound in America, we'd call it the Euro musical sound, but I don't know if that's condescending.
Totally.
But like things like Evita, things like JCC, things like Les Mis, even, that kind of big rock sound. And this one, I think, actually treads a little lightly on that, but we can talk about that in another point.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if in the 80s, we're just seeing Andrew Lloyd Webber and friends take over the musical theater scene so much that for this time period, this sound is just the musical theater sound. Like, this is just what musicals sound like in the mid to late 80s. And so, you know, for all sorts of different reasons that we've talked about in our burgeoning thesis of the history of musical theater, but like, you know, not enough composers going around, maybe to do with the AIDS epidemic in America, and like the vast success of these huge musicals and this pop rock sound. And so I wonder, is this, you know, it's a chicken or an egg question. Like, does this sound come from Tim Rice and Lloyd Webber and all these people making these musicals, or do they make these musicals in this sound because it's the era? Like, it is.
Yeah. It's, it is. I think it is really. Because obviously, you know, you can listen to Chess, you can listen to Jesus Christ Superstar, and you can listen to Evita. And obviously, Jesus Christ Superstar, well, potentially some of it was written by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Evita, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Chess, obviously Benny and Bjorn, or just Bjorn, I can't remember. Even maybe Les Mis, but I don't know.
I think that's right on the edge, but
not as much.
Yeah, but it's still in the. If it's a big bucket, it falls in it for me.
Yeah, and so the thing is, to me, that they sound really similar, and they are like perfect examples. In fact, do you know what else I'm going to throw in? I'm going to throw in Xanadu.
Yeah, I'd put that in there.
But do you know, like, it's got like that kind of 80s.
Yeah, you know,
poppy, you know, rocky vibe.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's. I do think then the strange thing about Blondel is it very overtly upfront bills itself as a rock opera. And if you listen to it now in the contemporary musical theater scene, it sounds like musical theater. I think it sounds.
Yeah.
It certainly has the influence of that rock pop, but like we open with an a cappella quartet of monks singing in four-part harmony. Like, that's not that pop rock sound. And it's not terribly influenced by that kind of like jam and guitar. You know, the synthesizers ride pretty light throughout the whole thing. It's certainly there, but it's... And it's...
Yeah, so it was interesting because I was reading a review about the... I think it was the 2000... No, it was this one. It was the 2017 production of it. And they were like, oh, it's just a shame that it wasn't as rocky as the original. The original was so good and rocky, and this one was just... Apparently was just scored for, like bass guitar and then, like, kind of, like, chamber orchestra.
Okay.
So much, like, lighter sound.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, it's just a shame it didn't rock as hard as the original. I'm like... The original didn't rock at all.
It didn't really like, rock really hard. And you know, like, I mean, perhaps it's a chamber orchestra. Yeah, it feels like a chamber orchestra is even more stylistically appropriate for this sort of
thing.
Like, it doesn't, other than being written in the 80s, and maybe whatever character they pull the Joseph thing and make them an Elvis impersonator.
The Pharaoh.
Yes, but in this one, there's another Elvis. Is there not?
There's an Elvis? Do you mean the Duke of Austria?
Someone's He's got like Elvis-y. A really like rock star sound to them.
Is it Blondel?
No.
There's the like travel through Europe like opener to Act Two, which kind of has a sort of a rockabilly vibe.
Yeah.
Or to it.
What's the one where it's like Paris? We want you to say one thing, and that's yeah. Who sings that?
Yeah. So that's the opening to Blondel.
Okay.
So it's just, it's kind of done in that style. In
I guess
that,
that's
like,
true. Yeah.
Rockabilly.
Exactly.
Da-ding-a-ding
but so
style.
Like,
yeah.
That's not, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but that doesn't feel like it needs the full 80s trappings for that to still be funny and still land nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think so. I think it totally sounds, I think the rock opera thing probably comes from maybe being like, we're not a musical, we're a rock opera.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? In the same way that Rent is a rock opera.
Right.
And it's still very... Nowadays, like, you need to go so hard to become a rock opera.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You need to be, like, Van Halen-style screaming and wailing, to be a rock opera.
Yeah, well,
and you kind of listen to this, and you're like, oh, it's quite light.
It's the difference between the original Tommy and the revival of Tommy. Is the original sits in that rock opera world, and then we see that it's actually just a piece of musical theater in disguise.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, because something like, it's weird though, because something like Jesus Christ Superstar, I actually probably would be inclined to call a rock opera.
Yeah.
And even now, depending on how it's scored. But I think Blondel is like, you know, rock opera light.
It's so much more.
It's like pop opera, maybe. Like,
yeah, pop opera. It's so much more narrative than something like JCC. Like, because there you're really capitalizing on that kind of rock star comparison. Whereas here, there's the overt discussion of Blondel wanting to be a quote unquote pop star in 1180. What's his joke? Mm-hmm. Like, I had a great piece with Send in the Jesters,
yeah.
A hilariously awful dig. But, like, it doesn't, you know, he doesn't need to be a rock star for that to land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's just that vibe of, like, he's like a guitarist in inverted commas, because he plays the lute.
Right.
And, like, with the kind of his backing singers, they're going for that kind of, like, I don't know, almost like Bon Jovi style. Do you know what I mean? Like, kind of sex icon.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Musician.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think musically, it is. It's just a complete capture of that sound. But where I actually think the genius of this lies is in its lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be appalled to say that this is some of Tim Rice's best writing.
Oh, yeah. It's so much fun. I did not expect the lyrics in this to be as good as they are.
Yeah, it's like, I almost feel like, because this is so curveball, so, I mean, it's in between Evita and Chess, right? Like, landmarks, these are pillars in the musical theatre, oeuvre.
Yeah.
And I almost just feel like he's like, right, I need to take those two seriously. For this one, I'll just have a good time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just kind of, like, take the rip a little bit.
Yeah, and, like, it's still, you know, when we hit our Chess or Evita episodes... I always run into, like, so much of their lyrics are, like, seeped in very obtuse metaphor and comparison. Like,
yeah,
I want to be a part of BA Buenos Aires, Big Apple. Why is it the Big Apple? We're drawing an intrinsic comparison to New York, kind of, but why is Evita singing? Like, there's, you have to draw a lot through your mind for this. Blondell, it's right on the surface. Anything they're saying,
yeah,
not a lot of metaphor, tons of wordplay and cleverness and like catchiness. I think the lyrics in this are almost catchier than the music in a bunch of ways.
Yeah, I would, because I couldn't sing you a song right now. No. Even though I've been listening to it for a week, I couldn't sing you a song.
Yeah.
And that isn't me to say I didn't like it. I enjoyed it. But I would go back and listen again to the lyrics. Like, I found myself laughing out loud. That doesn't happen that much.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I was playing it without headphones in, and my boyfriend would be like walking through the room, and like it was the asparagus line and the assassins one. And like, that's, you know, these are, on the one hand, I think you could call some of these things cheap musical theater tricks. Like he's spelling and ASS, what are you, an asthmatic? Like, or you know, these are like vaudeville jokes, or there's no rhyme for Richard. Like you could count on you know, it would take three hands to count songs that use a similar kind of joke in it, but it lands so well. It suits the characters, you know. It doesn't feel cheap in context.
No, exactly. And because I think I said it's because it's so, because it is light from the outset, like those monks, you know that they are kind of camp and funny right from the start.
Yeah.
You know, you're not entering into a weird Gregorian musical. You're just going to have a good, you're just going to have a good time.
Yeah.
And I think that's what allows it to kind of, you know, the tongue is planted firmly in the cheek.
Absolutely. From the moment the monks go like, yes, I see. This ain't no Hunchback of Notre Dame. Like, we're not going to like have this chorus that's always like, and we comment on the action. Like,
yes, exactly.
They're making jokes.
Have you got any favorites?
I can't see. This is why I got nervous when I said out loud, I find the lyrics so catchy, because I can never remember them.
That's fair.
You know?
Well, I've got some faves.
Tell me, I'll laugh with you.
Such a wet attitude, A, a heresy, B, an error, C, mad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you got that internal rhyme in there.
A heresy, B, an error, C, mad. I've listened to that 4 or 5 times just to be like, did you? Did you?
Yeah.
You did. You very much did. So good. You're off your trolley, get on your bike. Like,
that's
smart.
A good one. Yeah.
Do you have those phrases in the US?
I know enough to understand it. I mean,
right.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's so much of that reversal in here, which is built into the core of the show, is 11, you know, the 1180s through the lens of the 1980s.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And that is fun when they have those moments.
Yeah.
So good. In the song just before the assassin comes in.
So how on earth can I ensure that Richard won't return? I need a, what's the word? I mean, a what's it? Deus ex machina.
Sir, it's your lucky day.
It works so well. And that's one of my favorite things as well. See, when you put in, what are they called? What are those? I've used them before in this podcast and I couldn't remember. Like the uhs, the ums, the...
Oh, like filler words?
Yes, that's what you guys call it. I've had this literal conversation, so we're just going to call them that. See when people put them into lyrics purposefully to like use and enhance, I just think...
Right,
like,
to fill the phrase or be the rhyme. Yeah. Tim Rice's lyrics are very conversational. And I think that's where he shines the most fully. And I do think then that makes a couple of the songs in here, like the love ballads, the slightly more serious songs. What is it? Keep Running Back for More?
Yeah, Running Back for More. Yeah.
I don't think is that strong of a song. Because it's not capitalizing on some of that same comedy, some of that same cleverness. You know, it's trying to be like an 80s rock love ballad, just flat out, and it, you know, a couple times through afterwards, I would start skipping it because I don't need to hear it again.
Exactly. And I think it's one of those things. It's almost taking that box for almost like audition song, moment for lead male, moment for lead female.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of just taking, and it's like, okay, let's get back to business now. Let's have the fun.
And I do wonder if they know, because like, don't immediately after the monks go like, you know, to us it sounded like a mediocre B-side or something like that.
Well, so this is it. This is the whole trope about, so basically Blondell writes this song for King Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Called I'm a Monarchist,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, is kind of trite as anything but catchy as hell. And he comes to, as Richard's away off to the Crusades, he comes to his brother, John, mm-hmm. and is like, do you like this song? And then that's what prompts the whole, write him a song, write me a song. Nothing reminds of Richard, by the way.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then that's the song that eventually plays under the cell. But the whole point is that it is a bad song.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And exactly.
It's totally making fun of that whole thing of like, it's not the good music that rises to the top. It's the kind of mediocre earworm that will kind of flesh its way out.
Yeah, like what's the the Christmas song from Love Actually.
Bill Nye when he's like, this is complete shit.
Yeah, exactly. And like, he totally knows. Yeah, it's that, but in the 1180s.
Christmas is all around me. Come on and let it snow.
Yeah, what, is that?
What does he say? I need fingers. To find out.
I feel it in my toes.
I think he says, this is solid gold shit. Solid gold shit.
Yeah.
So good. Yeah, and that's exactly what this is. But poor Blondell, bless him, he really believes in it.
Yeah, no, he's just very earnest. It's very, you know, I kept thinking of Candide, too, when listening to this. There's something very, at least story-wise, of an innocent, you know, feudal person sent on an unexpected journey and looking for the best in life, no matter what.
Yeah, very Pippin as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what it is about the Middle Ages that spawns an unassuming lead character. But hey, you know, if it works, it works.
If it works, it works.
Yeah. I do have a question. I'm intrigued. What was happening in the States in the Middle Ages?
Were we here yet? It was just, I mean, by
no, you weren't there, but like, what was, do you know what was happening?
There were indigenous people and life was probably much better.
Okay.
You know.
Because I don't really know anything about it. Because when was like Christopher Columbus? Was that like 1700s?
This is like a rhyme that third graders in America learn because, you know, we wrongly idolize Christopher Columbus. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
1492.
Yeah, okay. So a good 300 years later.
Okay.
So yeah,
but he wasn't the first one, was he?
He wasn't the first one. So there might have been some. It was Leif Erikson.
Or Francis Bacon?
Oh, I don't know when Francis Bacon. I know Leif Erikson is generally considered one of the first conquerors of...
Oh, yeah!
Viking. Visitors. So that's more Viking time, but they, you know, they didn't stay, and they also didn't kill giant civilizations.
Yeah.
So, not much.
Well, the Vikings definitely did.
Yeah,
not to the same extent.
Maybe not so much in America. They weren't so much on a conquering spree there. But, you know, I'm also always wrong about history, so...
That's fair. I know. But it's really, I guess that's the thing about UK history is that it's just, there's so much of it.
Yeah.
It's very long. Yeah. It's a long book.
It's long and windy.
Windy. I think he said whiny. I was like, it's anything but. It's dark as sin. Medieval times. Woo!
The problems are gone. Observe how the rhymes flow. When you write your chanson, it's easy with John. The name with no rivals. Well, maybe Yvonne. Whereupon I must now recommend you improve certain stanzas
the places of Joan, I'll continue anon, for at our disposal's a whole lexicon. So poet, write on. For instance, there's Amazon and Oregon, although I do concede that in 1189 there rhymes you may not need. My growing reputation from here to Runnymede gives you the chance to be the second venerable Bede. There's Mastodon, Automaton, and Don should not be missed. Hootsmon, Peron, Pantechnicon, can Richard match this list? I see no use for Skeleton, but on the other hand, the use of John with Paragon is nothing short of grand. There's Silicon and Venison, and more at your command. Or Tarragon,
Accordion,
or Echelon,
Saskatchewan,
Iguanodon,
or Colon,
or Sri Lanka,
Ceylon,
Polygon, Garrison,
Wobegon,
Chiffon, Silly Midon.
One of these times you're going to come to America and I'm going to take you to a place called Medieval Times.
By the way, I am desperate to go to Medieval Times.
Are you aware of the existence of Medieval Times?
Of course I'm aware of the existence. Tommy, I'm an American pop culturalist. I know everything. I view my world through the lens of American pop culture. Yeah, of course.
I went to a 9-year-old birthday party at Medieval Times.
Oh, that's cute.
It was fun.
Did you get to like dress up? Because it was your birthday?
It wasn't my birthday.
Okay.
I attended a birthday party.
Okay, cool. But what age?
9.
What age was that? 9?
Yeah.
What did I do for a 9th birthday? I can't remember. For my 7th, we went to McDonald's.
How exciting.
And back when McDonald's did birthday parties. Flash from the past.
Oh, can you imagine the internet outrage nowadays? Anyway.
Yeah, it was actually quite interesting. We, as part of the party, you get like a backstage tour of like the kitchens and like the back area, and like it was quite funny because like so my brother was like filming just the party and then continued filming as we like went through, and one of the managers was like, "You can't film in here." And we're like, "Oh my god!" So we probably have some secrets. We have some like.
Ooh.
Pre-healthy McDonald's days secrets.
I mean, McDonald's is still unhealthy, but...
Yeah, but before, like, laws came into play about, like, you know, you have to call it...
Meat. Back in the Wild West of fast food, when you could put the rat meat straight into the hamburger.
Exactly, and it tasted even better. Anyway. So let's talk about progressive females of the Middle Ages / Blondel, the unlikely political satire.
I think this is one of the biggest things that kind of reminds me of Candide is Blondel and, what's her name?
Fiona.
Fiona are like on this journey as a duo with and without the assassin at certain points. And like variously fighting and getting along throughout the whole thing.
Yes.
And... I don't know where I was going with this.
Cool. Yeah, well, I think Fiona's just an interesting character. I think she's a really interesting character because right from the get-go, she is just like, she's kind of going off on her own. Like, she is 100%, independent woman, number one. She's very disparaging of her little love, Blondel. And kind of is not too happy that he wants to pursue a career in the arts.
Yeah.
She thinks there's better things to be doing. Mm-hmm. But basically, so Fiona is a member of the court of King Richard and has been there for 20 years. And she kind of wants out of her indentures.
Yeah.
Because she feels like she's served her time.
Mm-hmm.
And so she tries to get out. And goes to Prince John, to try and get out. And he's like, absolutely not. Don't be silly. You can't leave. And so she kind of runs away from that.
Right.
And takes matters into her own hands. And I think that's really good. That's very, a progressive.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly not something that probably happened in 1180. This is a contemporary construct.
No, she would be killed 100%. Yeah, immediately. Killed.
Yeah. but it does, yes. it lends some, it, I would say it's as, I don't know, hashtag patented Jim and Tomic, insightful as this show gets. You know, it's the part of the show that's either making a point or reinforcing a point, or is more than just the fluff on the poster.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I'd say there's two branches that we're going to talk about in this section of that. And I'd say definitely one of them. And like, I guess they all kind of come through the eyes of Fiona.
Yeah.
And her, the things that happen to her. But even like in Act Two, she's the one that, you know, manipulates everything to rescue the king. Blondo really doesn't do that much.
No, she's the brains of the bunch. She's the, you know, what gets him out of trouble.
Exactly. So I think that's really good. Because even, I guess even in the 80s, we were starting to see kind of the rise of the female. Obviously we just had Eva Perón.
Mm-hmm.
Hooray, hooray. Who, you know, still had kind of her flaws. And then we're just about to have Chess, where you, again, have these kind of really nice, strong, complex females.
Yeah.
And I feel like writers were just starting to become a bit more weird. And it wasn't just Tim Rice that was doing this, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I feel like they were really starting to...
Yeah, I think you're seeing it, like, to very oversimplify, in the 70s, we have the kind of complete destruction of societal standards and norms as it comes to these things, you know, free love, and we're gonna be humans of the world, and that's how we are. And I think in the 80s we swing back a little bit, but what you're seeing is the repercussions of that in a more structured society. So it's like a combination of the what were previous gender roles in, you know, the 50s and 60s with this new idea of, you know, and women can do things too. And you start seeing that reflected in the art like this.
Definitely. And it's good to see that it was happening. You know what I mean? Because now we don't really question it as much,
right?
But I feel like, you know, even something is in the background as Blondo, it's nice to see that there are still these characters that are like, hey, a decent role for a female that isn't, you know, the love interest.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's the thing, it almost feels like Blondel's the love interest. Do you know what I mean?
I wonder...
Because she definitely wears the trousers.
You know, the fifth time they rewrite this, I wonder if there's a way they could flip that a little bit. And I know it's the only good part that comes out of that Tim Rice interview in El Paso, but that with Loot, one of his big rewriting goals was to make both Blondel and Fiona a little more likable or relatable.
Yeah, he said likable, but I don't know. I mean, from listening to it and watching the original, I was like that I'd like them. I got them. It wasn't, you know, I mean, I wasn't like, oh, these people again. But I think just because it was a very light show, I didn't really care as
you don't
much.
Really matter.
You know what I mean? I was just like, give me some characters. I'm totally down with it.
Yeah.
But it was nice to have someone there who was more human, and I feel like Fiona was the kind of embodiment of that.
Yeah.
In many ways. I know, I'm very intrigued to see what happened with Loot. And because it's one of those because 80s Blondel is kind of fallen into myth.
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings style, do you know what I mean? Most of the people talking about it are only talking from the perspective, and I mean like in reviews and features on it, are kind of talking from the perspective of people who are reading about the 80s production as opposed to people who have actually seen it.
Yeah.
And I find that really, really interesting because it's very vague as to how they differ. So I guess I don't know, for someone who's listening out there who's maybe has seen
it
both
in the 80s,
I feel like that's really as a stretch to ask.
It's
but
true, but
who knows,
it's a really important piece of oral history that's missing. This is like a you know, well, as we found, because we live in not these places and not these eras and have to kind of piece mm-hmm. together and reconstruct these existences, there's not For a sure. lot of good documentation about Blondel. Which is surprising for how successful it was.
Yeah, because it still ran for 11 months.
Yeah. Like,
that's a long time. Even if it is off its end, it's on the Old Vic. Like,
yeah.
That's important. Yeah. Very, very interesting. So I'd be interested to hear that. If you have one of these, I don't know, maybe there's like six people out there who've seen, seen both. If you're one of the six, let us know and let us know how they differed. Because I don't know, I mean, what did you think? I didn't think it needed a huge rewrite.
No, I think, I mean, I maybe I'm developing a bit more of an allergy to that kind of 70s and 80s aesthetic.
Right.
But that's just in the setting and some of the time. Like, I mean, yeah. And, you know, who knows, maybe we're cursing the world with this, but I could see a pretty decent production of this hitting Broadway or off Broadway in the next couple of years without much change, you know?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think this would work in the States at all.
You don't think so?
No, not in the slightest. I just feel like, yeah, I don't think British history works across the pond.
But it's so, maybe then I'm just reading it differently. This doesn't feel like a historical piece to me. This feels more like Pippin. You don't need to know a darn thing about history to appreciate Pippin, even though it is historical fiction.
But it's so, maybe that's not what I mean. It's just very British in its delivery. Like, it feels very Gilbert and Sullivan.
It does feel Gilbert and Sullivan. Yeah.
It's not panto-y, but it's very British. Like, it's very, very British. And I don't know if that's going to fly in the States anymore. Certainly not on Broadway. I don't think that's going to fly. Because I think, we have kind of talked about this before, but it's something like Matilda, you know, they British washed it and they cleansed it of all its Britishness.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
And, you know, and you can Americo
right, because it's just explicitly in the plot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I haven't thought that all the way through. It is, it's fascinating.
I mean, maybe Luke has been Americo'd.
Yeah. I mean, give the monks one line that's like at the very beginning that's like, we know this is a bit of British history, but don't worry, we'll help you through it. Like, I think that, so one of the most, on the topic of British adaptations to American pieces of theater, one of the most fascinating examples of this I've seen is actually a play, is Noises Off.
Yes. Okay, great.
And if you look at, so the play, like the book play, was for a British audience, written by a British playwright, very much set in England. But then they made a movie of it, which everyone should watch, and Americanized it a whole bunch. But what they did was they made Michael Caine the director and gave him all the lines that were quintessentially British. And it's not, they're changes you'd never notice if you just watched one or the other, but only when you hold them side to side do you see, like, they change. You know, Michael Caine has a speech in the play, or the director has a speech in the play about King Lear, or a production of King Lear he's doing, which they changed to Hamlet for an American audience. And, like, there's a couple references, I think, of being done in time for tea, which also just seems like a stereotype I have of England. And they get rid of some of that sort of stuff. But, like, I don't think, I don't know. Maybe it didn't ring as quintessentially British to me, but I can't quite say why.
That's interesting because I think in its sound it's very British, because like you say, it's got that Euro musical vibe. But in terms of just, I would say a lot of the jokes, they just seem very British. But as maybe I'm doing it a disservice, maybe it totally would work. On the topic of Noises Off though, oh my god, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen.
It is literally
the funniest thing I have ever seen.
It's so good. I mean, we're veering into a whole new world, but if you watch the movie, which I highly recommend, watch it twice, and very specifically look for all the things that go wrong near the end, and you can see the actors struggle with those things in tiny, tiny ways at the very beginning. It's just magical. It is a wonderful piece of theater. It's one of the best play to movie adaptations I've ever seen.
That's interesting. I I don't know if I agree, because I think it just, I think that it needs to be live. Do you know what I mean?
I think it's much funnier live.
I think because I didn't laugh nearly, but then maybe because I saw the play first.
Yeah,
I knew the conceit.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Do you know what I mean?
I wonder. So I've often watched it in the context of like a high school technical theater class, both as a student and a teacher, and I wonder if that adds some of the live audience feel. Because
I wonder,
30 people around you.
Yeah, potentially. But yeah, anyway, that's a side note. One of the things I do think, and again, I don't know how this would fit into an American audience mindset. But so when this was written, there were loads of nods to Miss Margaret Thatcher and the complete state of the UK at that point in this sort of kind of tyrannical leader and the filthy poor, basically, and the powerless poor. It's very, I don't know, it's almost borderline satire at that stage. That isn't what Blondel is about.
Right.
At all.
There's not someone who's like, you know, they don't have, I don't know, Waggy Hatcher the Prince somewhere. Like,
right, exactly. Like, they stay very true to the actual, you know, medieval times, but just very, very interesting. Yeah. And then, so listening to it, when they talk about, like, the most expensive feat in history that's going to put, like, Britain on the map, I was like, literally, and then they're like, the Crusades!
Yeah.
I'm like, you could literally just shout, Brexit!
Yeah, exactly.
And it would be the exact same thing. But, you know, and just... But I guess in the way that the Crusades benefited the UK a bit more than Brexit probably will.
Right.
But it's that kind of vibe. But, I think...
Maybe I'm from an American standpoint, but I can't imagine there are big monuments to the Crusades that, like, you walk past in your town square that everyone's like, ah, yes, the good old good decision we made.
Well, no, but I guess it's because there's ancient history now for us.
Right. You feel like... You can, it's, you yeah. Know, no one alive is even related to it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a different world almost. But hey, maybe they'll have monuments for Brexit, big Brexit monuments. That'd be good, wasn't it? But apparently, they didn't really do that in the recent production.
I wonder if that would, because I read through a couple reviews of the 2017 one, and it sounded like for the most part it fell a little flat. Like, the people enjoyed the music and, you know, seeing the show, and the show is good, but like the production was lackluster. And I wonder if that would have given, because I do think, maybe back to the topic of making this succeed on Broadway, the thing that would stand in its way for me are, you look at shows that are successful on Broadway and they're issue shows. You know, we don't, fluffy shows don't do well in the contemporary Broadway environment.
Exactly.
And so if you can infuse it with a little bit of issue, which I think you could do, it might, like, that's the sort of thing that's gonna update it for a 2017-2018 audience.
I would agree. Like, I think kind of using Fiona and using her struggles at the start, while she's in the court, really kind of hitting that home, and maybe flashing back to John a bit more and finding out a bit more from what's happening at home. Because kind of in Act Two, once they're in Europe, they're very much in Europe. And I think maybe, jumping back a bit more to see kind of all of it. Because that's the thing is, John was one of the first kind of like bad kings and very much was out for himself. And would do kind of did horrible things. And so that's, I feel like you could have a bit more of that. But then if you did have that, would it be the same show?
Right. And it's also, I mean, you know, he's a, what's the word? He's a monarchist.
Ridiculous?
Well, he's a monarchist. So we're not like... You know, I hate to jump to too many assumptions, but I would wager a contemporary English theater-going audience, or certainly a contemporary Broadway-going audience, would lean more in the anti-Brexit category. And if we're infusing... I don't know. Like, I don't know how this lands then if you follow the metaphor all the way through. Like, does it become so full satire that we're laughing at these silly people in the show for following through with this conquest?
Yeah, I think definitely. But it's. I think you just need to kind of, yeah, I don't know, get kind of be highlighted more because it's almost just like a cheeky wink.
Yeah, exactly.
And then we're away from it.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. I think it would be worth pursuing just to try, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's lots you could do there. Just be even the odd line just to make it a little bit more contemporized.
Yeah, I think that would totally work. Combined with, you know, in our American Idol kind of America's Got Talent, whoever's got talent kind of world, with the Blondell looking for his pop song recognition, there's something very contemporary there. Between those two things, you could do like those are the things that would need updating, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely,
and wouldn't you just guess, from Pyrenees to Benidorm, this place is Richard Less. My castanets have clicked in me and I've wasted my ole. They always say manana, or he left here yesterday. Oh, we must be frank. Drawn a blank. Oh, my trip goodbye. Oh, let's Spanish fly. Now if it's easy as this, there is not a lot to do. So action men like Richard would be quickly passing through. Though some may say a viva and a Spaniel's wonderful, as matadors have often said.
It's just a lot of
oh, we must be frank. Oh, we draw a blank. Try. Good people of Spain, what a thrill it is to be here in your wonderful country, isn't that right, girls? But before we leave, we'd like to ask you one very simple question. What do you say, yeah? What do you say, yeah? What do you say, yeah? Yeah, yeah. Have you seen my key?
I see. No.
Oh.
Question. Musicals like Blondel.
Yeah.
Right? Musicals that have faded. Right? Do they deserve life?
Yes.
After
next
production?
Question.
Because so what about okay, so something like Blondel, we can probably agree, is actually pretty damn good.
Yeah. Well, also,
right?
I mean, I'm also for bringing back not good things. The only convincing argument I ever run into for not bringing back pieces of musical theater or art in general is if they were, you know, if we have grown as a society to realize that some part of them may not be, however you want to phrase it, the most sensitive, the most politically correct, the most, you know, we probably shouldn't bring back the Black Crook. We probably shouldn't bring back, you know, minstrel shows. Like,
okay, yes.
Unless you fall in that category, you know. But what do you mean by bring back? Do you mean by, so like, this is on our radar because they recently remastered the double LP into, you know, digital media and CDs. Or do you mean bring back, revive and redo and reexamine?
Yeah, I mean like to exist again, because it is like these are, yes, they are cast recordings, but they weren't made to be cast recordings. They were made to be pieces of theater.
Yeah.
So it's to kind of exist as a piece of theater. Because you know, if you think of something like obviously Encores over over the pond.
Yeah.
We don't really have anything like that over here.
Yeah.
Certainly not as big an institution thing where it's like, no, this is a gem from our past.
And Encores, I think, is a passion of love. I don't think there's a lot of, you know, it's not a big cash cow or anything.
No, absolutely not. But it's one of those, I think even with Encores, you know, the Encores'd, that would be right, that works. The Encores'd Assassins.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Which is
like,
a weird
that
choice.
That didn't need Encores, did it?
Yeah, it's been revived.
Yeah, very successful revival.
Neil Patrick Harris was in it. It's performed in regional theaters all the time.
Yeah. Like. But that, you know, it picks up and it does pick up some other goodens. Right. But I don't know. I just think it's like, I don't know. It's an interesting point where, you know, there's so many shows out there that have literally just, you know, there'd be like six people, like say literally six people who would know them and probably love them.
Yeah.
And it's actually, because that thing is like, if it weren't for, you know, the stars aligning, the eclipse passing, and us discovering Blondel,
right.
I'd have never.
You know
what I mean? I'd have never.
Ever.
Not and even like, the pool of Tim Rice would have,
right.
have gotten exactly. me into it, because I would have been like, everyone makes a blunder.
Yeah. Cool.
But, and I feel like that's a shame, because I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And like even, you know, and apologies to the three people who I've forgotten about, but I live in a world where I get 2,000 comments a day about like, have you listened to this? Have you listened to that? And some of them are pretty obscure stuff. And Blondel has never crossed my radar. And it's Tim Rice, and it played for 8 months, and it's good. And no one's heard of it. And I wonder...
Yeah.
I also wonder if this kind of, you know, do we bring it back? Do we revive it? Do we keep it alive? Question that has changed in the past 5 years, you know, where people on Tumblr can post about these sorts of things and like develop their, you know, there's the internet is infinitely fractal and you can find a fan group for whatever you want. And like, that's, we're seeing a resurgence of these things. And so I also think there's something, you know, it feels fun to be in our position right now to be like, hey, all y'all out there, have you heard of this thing? We found something. We found a, you know, we did, like went treasure hunting and found this musical that not many people have heard of.
I feel like it is a total thing that's been happening. As fan culture is becoming a thing unto itself.
Yeah.
I think people are constantly on this search to be the fan.
Yeah.
Doing to be like the, I actually know everything about this. I am the champion for this piece.
And it's and it's beautiful.
And that's quite cool.
It's beautiful. It's dangerous. I mean, this is probably where we should talk about it a little bit, but the whole Great Comet Twitter, you know, saga.
Perfect time to talk about it, Tommy. Perfect time to talk about it. What a fantastic segue.
Yeah.
Yes. Social bloody responsibility.
Yeah, it's born out of this social media attachment that exists around these pieces of musical theater. And, you know, can I tell you, Jimmy, in a tangential way, you know, not specifically, not explicitly, not on my own, but I feel responsible. We're in this world. We're in the land of online musical theater commentary. We talk about musicals that either we haven't seen or aren't a part of or are old, and like encourage this additional layer of discussion and, you know, fandom of these sorts of things. You know, Hamilton certainly lit the pile of gunpowder, but there was plenty before, and there's plenty on the outside of that too. And it's us.
But what I would say is what we aren't doing are calling people racist who aren't racist.
I sense you have an opinion about these things. I agree.
Wait, you're glad.
I agree.
Like,
I do think there's nuance to it all.
I think so, but it's one of those to... You can't deny that with Comet, I mean, obviously we are completely biased, and like Comet means more to me, I think, than any other show has ever meant, just because of the experiences
right.
it has brought me, and I will hands up and say that I am biased.
Right.
But, you know, even just looking at it from an outside perspective, at the moment, there is no more diverse a show. Has there ever been as diverse a show?
Right.
And for people who are just flat out ignorant and don't know anything about it, to just turn around and see a hashtag and be like, okay, I'll do that. Racist. It's racist.
Yeah.
It's just, it infuriates me, because that is a lack of social responsibility.
Yeah.
We've all seen Black Mirror. Do you know what I mean? We've all seen what happens when you hashtag things.
Right.
Bees will fly out and kill you. Like, that is what's literally happened to the Great Comet.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
So, I agree with you. To be devil's advocate, it gets you know, in our light speed millisecond information super world we live in right now. Like, yeah. Let's say on a hypothetical, we're talking about this musical Blondel that, you know, no one has heard about, and we are professing to be authorities on it to a certain extent because we've listened to it and we've done research on it and we discuss it, and that's the sort of thing we do. But what if we get something wrong, which we do all the time? By sheer definition, we don't know that we got it wrong. If there are all sorts of scenarios where we get something wrong in the wrong way or have the wrong assumption about something, and all it takes is a couple button clicks or an influential tweeter or someone to get that snowball rolling. And once it's down the hill, even if it's based on false assumptions, you know, there's no stopping.
But I'd say it. I don't know, because the things that we get wrong are, you know, seeing Lindsay Stirling instead of Lindsay Mendez.
Right. Do you know what I mean? That's just because we haven't yet and because we think we're pretty thorough in our research.
But I would say I am pretty thorough in my research because I feel like I have a social responsibility. Because we are putting out ideas there and because we do have a following, I think you instantly have a social responsibility there to do your research, fact check.
Yeah.
Like, that is... We all know now the world that we live in, the world of gorgeous and lovely fake news. And we know that we need to fact check everything. We can't trust anything on face value anymore.
Yeah.
But it's even. I think it's just so important.
Yeah. It's so. Yeah. I agree. I find it so tricky. Because, like, we're not talking hard and true facts here. You know, we like the concept of a fact is something I think we're redefining in 2017. And I don't mean that in that kind of alternative facts kind of sense, but in the idea that we are all human beings and things only exist through our perception of them, and our perceptions are different. You know, so for easier things, like, let's say, I don't know, the speed of light or how much I weigh or, like, constants, yes, facts, easy. But when we start treading into, like, was this casting decision made through some kind of racism or institutional racism or as because of it, maybe not even explicitly so, but as a result of it, it's harder to define... It's harder to agree on the facts there. It's harder to come to a mutual perception that equates.
I would totally agree with you on that point. And I would say that, you know, there is a lot of nuance to what happened there. It wasn't by any stretch the perfect way that things should have been done. Do you know what I mean? It's not a case of they're completely in the right and this is all a farce. But the thing that I take issue with is the snowball that surrounded it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there was just too much of that, and it severely, you know, affected things, and incorrectly, like it just flat out incorrectly. So that's where my issue comes from.
Yeah, you know but so perhaps bringing it back a little bit, should we revive the unknown? Should we, you know, Jimmy and Tommy be doing this podcast about Blondel, a relatively unknown musical? I think, absolutely, because of the power this sort of stuff has, you know, in a world where every background character in the movie of Les Mis has gifs about them on the internet, like, Carrot Holding Man and like, or
all I love the, Carrot Holding Man. Oh my God. Right? Fuck yeah, Carrot Holding Man. That's me on Tumblr. That's me.
Exactly. Or like all of the fan art out there about the / fiction of the Minor Mormons and Book of Mormon and like animatics of, you know, their honeymoons together. Like, people have, and I think it's all wonderful. I think it's all great. And you're right. There's a response. There's an implicit responsibility that comes with
for
it
sure.
because you profess to be some kind of owner or communicator of the art with it. And it takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, you and I both know this, like to go into this sort of stuff, to figure this stuff out. It takes a lot of work to do these things justice at least 70% of the time.
For sure. No, for sure. yeah, I don't know. I just think social responsibility. I think that, like, let this be a lesson to us all, and let this never happen again.
Oh, it's going to happen 30 more times. Like,
I know, but it really shouldn't. And I mentally won't cope with it. Like,
yeah.
I'm still recovering. I'm still recovering.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
And I know that sounds so stupid because it is just a show at the end of the day. But when it's your life, do you know what I mean? When it's your life, when it's the lives of people that you've met and interacted with and care about, like, that's something else.
And I know you're saying this to say this out loud, but I would imagine you don't have to justify this to anyone who listens to this podcast, and certainly not to me. Like, in a world where people have vehement opinions over whether or not Lucille Ball or Angela Lansbury was a better MAME, like, these are our lives. Yeah. These are things we connect to. These are things we care exactly. deeply about. I do think it is interesting to talk about.
Angela Lansbury. Yeah, I know, completely.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting to consider that, like, we, and I mean that both in the royal sense and in the collective sense, are spinning up this kind of, like, secondary contingency to specifically musical theater, in our case, certainly to all sorts of pop culture things. But there is something, maybe it's confirmation bias and just because it's in our world, but there is something special and unique about it in musical theater world. And, you know, we have Lin-Manuel Miranda to thank or blame for that with his Ham for Ham internet presence and his wonderful Twitter jokes. But, like, every show nowadays is either expected to or just accidentally generates this kind of secondary existence on the outside of it. You know, we're doing that with.
I mean, one of my other big passions is the world of drag. And certainly in RuPaul's Drag Race, there has been some severe, like, dark problems to do with that, and social media, and, you know, like, racism, like, just flat out racism has occurred because of fandoms. And it's so dangerous.
Yeah.
It's just so dangerous.
I mean, maybe this will be our crystal ball for the show, but I would say give it 2 or 3 years before we see a musical or similar, you know, kind of theatrical production that is kind of the Edwin Drood of social media, where they totally blur that line between the piece of fiction we're putting on stage and the world that exists outside of that piece of fiction. Whether it is, you know, like, in the simplest terms, like, vote with your phones now. Who killed Edwin Drood tonight? Like, something in that kind of world. Like, there's something fascinating about it. It's certainly contemporary, and there's certainly artistic commentary to be had about it. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see, especially, you know, Evan Hansen is taking the world by storm in a post-Hamilton world. With it, all of its social media trappings, I would not be surprised to see, you know, Facebook the Musical soon, where half of it's streamed live while it happens, and depending upon how many likes or crying faces the live streamed video happens, changes precisely the next song they sing, or whether they, you know, murder an audience member or something.
It actually sickens me to my stomach, like, the thought of that, because that's not why I go to theater.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's not why I consume art. I consume art for the old traditional way of feeling something in the real world.
Yeah.
Like,
but it's changing.
But, hey.
But so you say that, I'm going to challenge you because I don't think you can anymore. I don't think you can. We saw Great Comet. We saw Great Comet after having listened to the cast recording. And after having experienced all sorts of parts of it, you know, via social media, via, you know, I'm not talking watching bootlegs. I'm just talking, like, knowing about that kind of show and, like, knowing people's reaction to it and what makes it popular and its history, you know.
But
I can't.
No, but my feelings for Comet happened when I listened to the cast recording, when I had a physical experience with it myself. I wasn't, like, being like, what do other people think? Oh, other people like it. Cool, I'm in.
No, absolutely. But I think there's still, you know, it's still an 80% experience. I don't think I'm ever going to be able to go into a musical blind ever again. Like, go see it, you know? I just think it's impossible. like they put the poster on the door. Like,
yeah, but no, there's, I mean, there's things that's fair because that's what is,
yeah,
physically,
but I mean, but like, even beyond that, there's hype around, and you know, it's just because this is the world I'm in, but
yeah,
I will know that the show has been in development for so long and these people have been attached to it, and you know, yes, we feel this, yes, way about these sorts of things, and it's these artists, so we have assumptions about these sorts of things they do, and like,
for sure,
you know, who didn't, you know, when everyone wanted to go see Moana because Lin-Manuel Miranda had a song in it, you had assumptions, yeah, about that affected how you viewed the art, that are based on this kind of secondary cultural thing. And certainly those existed in a pre-internet age where you could read newspaper, mm-hmm, reviews or hear from your friends or listen to the cast recording, whether it was a CD or a, you know, record. But yeah, not, there's something just more about it now that, mm-hmm, is scary and fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, I dare on the side of scary.
Yeah.
But hey, at least social media and all that jazz has brought us Blondell.
Yeah.
And I'm happy about that.
It's true. It's true. I'm happy this musical's in my life.
I generally, I know it sounds so weird, but I was, yeah, thinking that. I was just like, this, I'm like, I'm really pleased.
Yeah.
It's such a strange, yeah, thing to say.
It was such,
I'm very pleased that I found this.
Yeah. I mean, that maybe that's kind of what I was talking about. Like, as I said, I knew nothing about this, knew very little of, mm, what to expect about it, didn't know what kind of reputation it had, didn't have any assumptions, mm, about it. That was fun.
Yeah, totally. Totally. A nice, yeah, just an enjoyable experience. So as you're like, hey, this is,
yeah,
they're rhyming stuff with John. Great. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, fab.
Yeah,
I'm,
you don't,
totally down.
I don't get that very much anymore. You know, I'm,
yeah, yeah, it's difficult.
I'm envious of the people who comment and they're like, have you heard of the music? Did you know they made a musical of Titanic? Yes.
Like, yes.
You know, I'm envious of you and your like ability to discover things that you haven't heard of and know, yeah, nothing about.
Well, that's it. It's like, we, you know, we discovered it once upon a time,
mm-hmm,
but I guess the well is slowly but surely drying up.
Yeah.
But hey, that's why lots of people need to keep creating musicals. Come on, everyone.
Please, go write one right now. That was Blondell.
It was. Who knew?
Who knew? Go listen to it if you haven't. It's worth it.
No, and like, seriously, go listen to it.
Yeah, do it.
It's not easy to get, but
it might be easier soon, but you'll find it somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. If you go hunting, we've listened to it.
Yeah.
So therefore, in fact, I was going to keep this secret, but do you want to know a fun, interesting musical theater trivia?
Yeah.
I have actually bid on the LP on eBay because I
really
want it. Yeah, I weirdly love it. Like,
that's...
I weirdly love this show. I think just because it took me so much by surprise. I think, uh-huh, that's what it is. I'm like, I'm charmed. I'm hugely charmed.
Jimmy, you know what our goal is? Our goal is to find the person who outbid you on eBay now, because you're probably soulmates.
Well, how do you know I'm going to be outbid?
Oh. Well, because we put it on the podcast.
Yeah. Well, no, because it's fine. The auction will be up by the time this uploads.
All right.
Whoop, whoop.
Well, cross your fingers, everyone, that Jimmy's won his bid.
Exactly. Yeah. Hey, Tommy, Blondel's all well and good, but I want to do something else next week.
Well, have I got a quiz question for you?
I hope so, because that's the format of the show.
Originally, Act 1 of this show that we're doing next week was slated to end with a round of musical chairs emceed by a gorilla. However, the producer of the musical didn't think that this number worked, much to the dismay of the choreographer. Strangely, when they adapted the musical into a movie later, this same choreographer ended up performing in the new number that replaced the Gorilla Musical Theater Chairs, musical chairs piece. What show?
I'm sorry, but who ever thought you would ever say the sentence, a round of musical chairs emceed by a gorilla? Who ever thought that? Do you know what I mean? When you woke up this morning, did you think, I'm going to say this sentence?
When we started this podcast, I actually wrote a list of goals. Number one was get invited to a Broadway show, and number two was say the sentence to the sentence, a round of musical theater chairs emceed by a gorilla.
So does this mean that after this next week...
That's it, we're done. That's it. Done. It's been a good run.
All goals achieved. All goals achieved. But no, don't worry, Tommy's staying. I hope. Yeah. Yeah, okay, he's staying. Good. If you want to get in touch with us, you absolutely can and should. Come find me over on Twitter, @AsInHendrix, and YouTube at the exact same handle.
And I'm Musical Mash on Twitter and Musical Theater Mash on YouTube, or check out our show Twitter, Jim and Tomic.
Or you can hop on over to our website, jimandtomic.com, which has a link to our fabulous Reddit discussion where we will be chatting up a 1980s storm.
I plan on
it, and everyone's going to love it.
I'm only going to respond in minstrel tunes.
Great. I'm going to hold you to that. Good. Are you going to respond as much as you've responded recently?
Exactly as much, 100%.
Excellent. Good. Ha ha ha. Hey, let anyone you think will like this know about it. And we will see you next week.
See you then. Bye, everyone.
Bye.